Warning. This product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
We don't want to waste your time, so we won't. Vuse is vapor done right. Simple, sleek, stylish. Because when you find a vape that goes with everything, everything just clicks. Find Vuse at your local convenience store down the block.
Underage sale prohibited. Vuse is a vapor product. Website restricted to age 21 plus tobacco consumers. Copyright 2026 RJRVC.
The Sherwin-Williams Summer Sale is here. Get 30% off select paints and stains or 35% off our newest product, Emerald Symmetry, July 17th through the 27th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
Hello and welcome to Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week, we bring you the best news, views, and interviews with the CEOs, founders, clinicians, politicians, journalists that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and founder of a health tech company myself, which is called POCDOC, that's P-O-C-D-O-C. Our health check, our healthy heart check, is now the number one diagnostic test on the high street. And it gives you in 8 minutes, just using your phone, the equivalent of the NHS health check. So if you are interested in that, you can go to any of the major high street pharmacies. You can find it on Amazon, or you can find it on our own website, which is POCDOC.co. That's P-O-C-D-O-C.co. And thank you very much, as always, to POCDOC for supporting the show. Thank you also for everyone who is listening live on the wonderful UK Health Radio. We love UK Health Radio. We love the live platform. We have listeners in over 50 countries every single month and all around the world. And we're super thrilled about that. Thank you also if you are listening on demand on Spotify, Apple, etc., and any of the podcast platforms. It's great to have you. We have downloads now from, I checked the other day, it's actually over 60 countries now, which is insane, every month. So hello to everyone from Panama through to Pakistan, and from, I'm going to try and say another one, from Chile to, I don't know another one, but there's lots of people all over the world. Thank you very much for listening. And if you're watching this on YouTube, hello. And if you're watching the clips on my Instagram channel, which is at Health Tech Hour or at Steve Roost, it's great to see you. Today is a very, very special show. So we are very lucky, the Health Tech Hour, we are very lucky that we have become the media partner to Digital Health Rewired 2026. So if anyone works in health, you will know what Digital Health Rewired is. It is the UK's leading digital expo conference in Birmingham every single year. And it's really unique in that it unites NHS leaders, innovators, researchers, startups, investors, which is a really broad church. And the reason I love it, and I do love Rewired, even before we became a media partner, actually, is because it brings together such a broad church. So it's, there are lots of different conferences that focus on one aspect. Digital Health Rewired is actually one of the only conferences that brings everybody together. And it's fantastic. So the main focus on it is really around digital technologies being used to increase productivity, improve equity, and improve patient outcomes. It's actually happening in a couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, 24th to the 25th of March at the NEC in Birmingham. It's really big. It's really great. And if you are in health tech, med tech, the healthcare system in the UK, it really is a must attend event. Loads of networking, learning. There's all kinds of different talks and things. Lots of like new releases get announced at Digital Health Rewired. It's sort of kind of like an Apple style thing. People use it to announce new versions and new releases. It's really buzzy. So I can completely recommend it. Again, even before I became a media partner for the event, I was an attendee and paid. So there you go. We, though, have a really fantastic exclusive offer as the media partner. So Health Tech Hour, listeners of Health Tech Hour, can get an exclusive 10% discount on your ticket. So all you need to do is at checkout, use the code RW26HTH. That's RW26HTH on registration to get 10% off. And the event is actually free for everyone in the NHS and public sector. But if you are a company or a founder or whatever, this gives you the chance to get a 10% off your ticket. We will put that code out on the socials as well. And we will also talk to UK Health Radio about putting that code out as well. So anyway, as part of that, we have one of the key speakers, the key most exciting people to be at Digital Health Rewired on today's show, Kavita Palmer, who is the CEO and founder of Word360, which is a multilingual translation platform being used across the NHS. I think they're now in 50 or 60 trusts. And actually, they enable real-time translation into over 450 languages, which is actually insane when you think about it. And it's great to have you on the show. We've never done a show on this issue of language and translation and the importance of really making sure that everybody can understand what's going on in all levels of the healthcare system. So I think it's going to be a really great show. So Kavita, welcome to the show.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for having me on your show.
And you're calling in from Dubai at the moment. Everyone okay there?
Everyone is fine. Everyone's good. Sun is still shining.
Great, good. Well, look, let's jump straight into it. So what is the kind of origin story of Word 360?
So actually, it was something that came about from my original job as a clinician, as an optometrist. And I used to work in the health sector. I used to work in public and private. And I worked about 11 years in domiciliary care, so working with in hospitals and nursing homes, and really got to see a different side of eye care, if you like. And actually, that was just gave me the kind of basis of understanding about healthcare. The inception of Word 360 came a couple of years later, after I'd kind of done a couple of trials. I was the kind of person, Steve, where I couldn't work for myself. Obviously, you being an entrepreneur yourself will know how it's very hard to work for yourself. So I was always looking for an opportunity, looking to fill a gap, looking to solve a problem, as you do. And I actually started off in the first instance. My first job was creating clothes for elderly and disabled people. So okay. I used to work in nursing homes, and I'd always see people who had Alzheimer's, dementia, or different kind of health conditions, if they were immobile in some way or had a physical disability, to make it easier for carers, they'd be in kind of big T-shirts, baggy trousers, to make them easier to be transported, hoisted. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, actually, that's not really a dignified way of living. If you're a gentleman who's served in the war and you've always worn a Prince of Wales blazer and a shirt, actually, yeah, that's kind of what you always want to wear, but your health has not allowed you to do that. So I actually started designing clothes for people to look like they were wearing clothes that you and I would wear. So blazers, magnetic shirts, open back clothing, things that would allow people to look dignified and be able to dress independently. That was my first kind of stab at entrepreneurship and working to solve a problem in healthcare. I sold that business. I became a baby factory, and not knowing how to scale a business at the time, especially clothing, it was something that was quite alien to me. So then I kind of wanted to try and develop a business that allowed me to continue to work in healthcare. And with my husband, we've identified a gap in the market in terms of interpreting. And so we recognize that in Birmingham in particular, which is where we're based, it's quite a diverse community, and you have quite a lot of multiculturalism. You have lots of different people with different communities and backgrounds. And we see it's an opportunity and identified a need to be able to support people to get through their care plans and healthcare easier. And language we identified was a big barrier to that. And that's kind of where it started off. That was kind of identifying that need. There's a small company that we that was in Birmingham that the owners were retiring. Well, actually, this is a real problem that needs to be solved. Mm. And that's kind of where it all started, really.
Okay, so how did you come across the original problem of all of the problems that you could have ended up on?
I think we were already looking at different problems to solve. So there's lots of different problems in there. You know, we have to work with our strengths and working in healthcare. There's always lots and lots of different problems. Yeah. And so this was one that we were looking at, kind of domiciliary care, looking at how we could support people with that. And it's playing to your strengths, obviously. I'm Indian origin, so I've got lived experience of having family and friends who've had language barriers over the years, elderly grandparents. So I knew that actually that is a real problem, whether it's in the UK or globally. You know, as increased globalization, the need for multilingualism, if you like, is evident beyond healthcare, but healthcare predominantly, because it's so important that you get it right. And this, it can really affect patient outcomes if it's not done properly.
Yeah, and what is the kind of current data or evidence around bad patient outcomes due to lack of language, or sorry, due to a language barrier? What kind of exists, or what, you know, that would be super interesting.
So actually, there's lots of fragmented data. There isn't actually one single report that kind of collates that kind of information together. But if we look at the DARZI report, if we look at the kind of Ockenden report, health inequalities is a factor that comes and, you know, rears its ugly head time and again. Understanding the cultural needs, patient choice. You know, I think I remember something in the DARZI report where it said, you know, the inverse care law seems to apply, where those in greatest need tend to have the poorest access to care. Mm. And that really is something that's prevalent within cohorts of ethnic minorities and disadvantaged communities, where they are sometimes treated differently because they have a language barrier or a sensory barrier, for example, somebody who's deaf or hard of hearing. That is a very, very simple, that is a particular challenge in terms of access to care, because clinicians don't always know what to do in that scenario. Yeah. So there's a disconnect between the intent, which is to help somebody get the right care, and knowing how to solve that problem.
So of all, like, let's dig into how does Word 360 actually work, or where did you start? Because there is so much content, obviously, out there in health of all levels, right? From the, you know, the invitation to a GP appointment, to the letter after a GP appointment, to the talking during a GP appointment, to hospitals, to every, I mean, where do you start? It just seems like an enormous task.
Great question. It is about the whole patient pathway. It's that whole patient journey. And it can't just be that one little flash in the pan moment where they have access to language support. It needs to be an integrated end-to-end solution, cradle-to-grave solution that ensures that that patient receives equitable care, like you and I would, from the moment that they receive an appointment right through to when they exit the NHS, because they've found the solution that's right for them. To answer your first question, from inception, we delivered in-person services, Steve. So it was, dare I say it, an Uber for interpreters. But essentially, it was like that. You essentially had the ability to phone us up, email us. This is going back sort of 13 years when we first started, and go, I need an interpreter tomorrow at 10 o'clock in Romania. And then we would search our databases and go, okay, actually, we've got somebody who can go to that location, and we kind of make it happen and work out the logistics to get that person there.
Yeah.
Obviously, with evolution of technologies and the SaaS platforms and the increased appetite for digital transformation, it made sense that we started looking at systems that automated that process. So that's how WordSki came about, which was our kind of technology that allowed you to kind of use that kind of intelligent mapping to allow you to identify, you know, put in the prerequisites of what that patient needs. It could be something as granular as, do I want a male or a female? Do I want it, you know, do I want to be able to access the support in person, by telephone, by video? And that kind of intelligently maps it to be able to match it to that patient need.
Okay. But did you start with when you with this WordSki thing? I guess I'm just still trying to get my head around like the enormity of the task, right? Like, as in, it's just such a trying to be able to provide access to all healthcare content for all health journeys in the exact language that everyone wants to access. That's an enormous task. So how do you break it down so it's like achievable? Because it's like an insane, it could be overly scary. You know, I'd probably stick my head in the sand.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'm glad that you appreciate the magnitude of this, because not everybody does, and they oversimplify it, thinking, well, can't you just use Google Translate? And, you know, why are you overthinking this, you know? But your point is so correct, is in every single clinical setting, that the role of the interpreter is to be impartial. They are there to interpret word for word what is being said from the clinician to the patient. And a lot of that information may not necessarily be technical, like a, you know, if we're looking at a clinical research paper, it will just be layman's terms that allows you to communicate. But equally, the nuances come in when you're talking about things, the kind of colloquialisms that we use. So things like, I need to induce you because you're about to go into labor.
Yeah.
How do you say that in 150 different languages? You know, that, and that's where our training, our the inductions that we do, the qualifications that we need to make sure that they have, the safety, you know, all of our interpreters, translators need to have enhanced DBS checks for to make sure that they are safe and from that whole kind of security perspective. And also kind of digitally, the information governance. So there's all these different elements that we had to kind of almost create that SOP to make sure that we could standardize it. And that comes from not trying to be everything to everyone and really understanding the problem that you're solving to be able to then scale out. So we didn't decide to be exactly that, everything to everyone. We were based in the Midlands and we stayed in the Midlands for a very long time. We made sure that we were the best in that region. We made sure that from primary care to acute care to mental health care, we were building our understanding, building the different challenges that come with primary care. And, you know, not just in terms of the language and terminology, but actually the day-to-day logistics of it. You know, you've got a 5-minute appointment for a GP, whereas for mental health, you may have a crisis team where you need to be able to access support straight away, right through to, you know, maternity, where you have immediate requirements to language. So all of those different nuances had to be addressed. So it was slowly kind of, I use the example of a tree. It's growing those roots so that you can grow a healthy tree, you know, laying those roots, laying those foundations, so it's sustainable.
So what am I trying to say? This is why live radio is great. So and this is why I love doing the show, because I just love learning about new things and you know, listening to entrepreneurs building things and stuff like that. So what is the obligation of the NHS to provide unique or this, however you say, access to content, access to health in whatever your language of preference is? And where is this spectrum between obligation versus, well, I think we all know, and the data says, Darcy report and Ockenden and all these other things, that if a person has a language barrier, presenting health information and dealing with that person on that patient journey in a language they understand is going to lead to a better outcome. But is it like, where are we on the spectrum of obligation versus intention, I guess?
I think we sit kind of firmly in the middle. I think that you've got your EDI charters and obligations to ensure that you're offering equity of access. But then you've got your governance around your accessible information standard that came out in 2016, I think, where, you know, there is an obligation for the NHS to be able to provide information in a format that can be understood by that patient. So whether they've got language, whether it's got sensory or communication difficulties, so easy read, large print, it's about patient choice, because ultimately, as you say, it's the cost to the NHS. You know, if that particular patient doesn't understand the information that they're given, it could lead to poor condition management. If they don't understand the condition that they've got, they could present later, and there could be a cost due to more advanced disease. So there's the logical element of it as well.
Yeah, that's super, super interesting. And I want to pick up on more of that after our first commercial break. So we will go for a 2-minute break now, and then we'll come back to talk to Kavita Palmer, who is the founder of Word360, one of the largest multilingual translation platforms at use in the NHS currently, as part of our Digital Health Rewired special. And remember that you can get a 10% discount using the code RW26HTH at checkout when you get your tickets for Digital Health Rewired, which is the UK's largest digital health conference. We will be back after this break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Insurance isn't one size fits all. That's why drivers have enjoyed Progressive's Name Your Price tool for years now. With the Name Your Price tool, you tell them what you want to pay, and they'll show you options that fit your budget. So whether you're picking out your first policy or just looking for something that works better for you and your family, they make it easy to see your options. Visit Progressive.com. Find a rate that works for you with the Name Your Price tool. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact you may not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. Pop over to Progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with discounts that are easy to come by. In fact, 99% of their auto customers earn at least one discount. Visit Progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello, and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, fabulous Kavita Palmer, who is the founder of Word360, a multilingual translation platform used in over 50 NHS trusts, and ensures that health content and health journeys are available in over 450 languages. And I forgot to mention, this is our Digital Health Rewired special as part of our media partnership with Digital Health Rewired, which is the UK's largest health tech conference. It's happening on the 24th and 25th of this month, March, in Birmingham at the NEC. And you can get a 10% discount on your tickets as a result of our partnership with Digital Health Rewired. Just use the code RW26HTH at checkout. That's RW26HTH. Kavita, let's talk about your Wordski platform. So basically, you started off, by the sounds of it, creating the Uber of health interpreters, which I think is sort of what you said. But then you kind of tried to have transitioned into more of a digital first approach. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Absolutely. So as kind of technologies involved and kind of as NHS trusts want to look at interoperability, digital transformation across the NHS, it stands to reason that they go to kind of question the validity of having somebody turning up on site every time that there needs to be some level of communication with a patient. So
it's not even validity. I could see it just being like a convenience issue.
Absolutely. Like, oh, like, God,
you don't want to have to try and connect the dots and stuff.
Well, I think COVID was a great catalyst for people wanting to kind of look at or having to move to alternative approaches, right? So telephone and video conferencing is now the norm across most clinical appointments. And therefore, having language support within that just seems like a sensible choice. So,
oh yeah, like telephone, interesting. Okay,
exactly that. Yeah, exactly that. And it solves that point that you made earlier about instant access. So you can access an interpreter anytime within 30 seconds. That's amazing, you know, compared to waiting for an interpreter to turn up on site, you know, in a few hours, maybe in a few days, if it's a rare language. You can now access somebody because we can access our national global talent pool in an instant. And just like, you know, that kind of Uber model, interpreters can pick and choose the work that they do. So you're always going to have somebody who's going to go, yep, I'll take that deal and I can support that patient.
Okay. And so, like, if I'm calling up, what are the most common languages, obviously not English, non-English languages that you guys deal with through WordSki?
It massively varies. Just to give you a bit of an idea, in sort of London, Birmingham, Manchester, we delivered around about 167 different languages last year. It's great. Yeah. We've got this whole game in the office where you have to try and name all of them. It's
But, yeah. 167.
It's a lot. But to answer your question, you know, it's interesting how you see migration shift. So if you'd asked me this question 10 years ago, it would have been Punjabi, Urdu, Romanian, Polish, obviously after Brexit, and then with, you know, civil unrest around the world, you've seen that changing to things like Kurdish, Sorani, Arabic, Ukrainian, languages that you didn't even think that, you know, we would service. And now we could be looking at Czech, we could be looking at Slovak, we could be looking at Twi, Oromo, Igbo languages.
What's Twi? I've never heard that one before. Yeah, what's so that? African Where's languages. That?
African, that African. Yeah, absolutely. So anywhere where there's been, you know, we're great at helping people in the UK. So when you've got refugees, asylum seekers, a lot of these people, they'll move into an area and they'll need healthcare, they'll need support from wherever they've come from. So at that point, you need language support to help them get through that healthcare period to then allow them to integrate into society. And having that language support is important in some of those languages that, like you said, may not even have heard from.
Shout out to all the Twi speakers listening. Yeah. I bet you've got some. I'd love to give us a message if you're a Twi speaker. I'd love to. That would be great.
Absolutely.
That's super interesting. And so how do you feel about the issue of, you kind of mentioned it earlier, but Google Translate, which sort of being a kind of, let's use Google Translate as the sort of like synonym for, you know, non-human, basically, sort of translation. What's your kind of take on that whole issue? Because you must get confronted with it all the time.
All the time. And quite rightly so. You know, it's obvious. It's the obvious thing. You know, we've all been on holiday and whipped out our phones when we've been in Turkey or Spain and, you know, need to tell the taxi driver where you're going. And this kind of leads into what problem are we solving? At the end of the day, we are looking about condition management. We're looking at how do we support patients to get the best outcomes, get them through the NHS quickly, effective and efficiently. Yeah. And so we, you know, when we look at that, a translation tool can come, does have a place, absolutely. In the, you know, we have, we are developing our own, it's going to be launched shortly, but it's about that blended service solution. So when you have something like Google Translate, you'll know that you could start having a bit of a conversation, but after a while, it's starting to go, actually, that's not exactly what I said. Or, you know, you can do very, very basic conversations. Like,
do you want to do like, it's really good for like single statements, right? Or written, if you see what I mean. But it's sort of like asynchronous, static stuff.
Absolutely. And in the NHS, for, you know, reception desk conversations, basic engagement with patients by the bedside conversations, it's fantastic. It absolutely has a place. And I could talk a little bit about that, but
although it's interesting, right? Because this is one of the things that I I don't know why I think about this, but it just tickles my brain. It's like, because we're Pocketdoc's a medical device developer, right? And obviously there are lots of people that develop medical devices all over the world. And the standard that we have to hold ourselves to in terms of validation and safety and traceability and verification and about everything. I mean, to the point almost where, you know, we have to know exactly how many pencils are in the pencil drawer at any one time, kind of thing. And whereas if you've got Google Translates being used on the fly, right? How on earth does somebody using Google Translate know that what Google just translated it into is right? That's
That's
what
it.
I kind of melts my mind. And there doesn't appear to be any validation or verification around that bit.
And that's the irony, right? That's absolutely that. You know, people use it frivolously without really understanding what the impact will be because it's available, it's accessible, and they think that that's the golden answer to everything. But think about the sovereignty of data. You know, where does that data go? It doesn't sit in the UK. It's ourselves. So, you know, information governance
And
teams, I'm
you
all
can't upload. That's the other thing.
in.
You won't be able to upload or really discuss
Right, absolutely. PII is a
confidential
massive
PII,
issue.
right? You won't be able to do
Yeah.
that.
But then what about the clinical risk and the potential litigation? You know, as we know, I was looking at a stat the other day, the NHS paid 3.1 billion pounds in compensation and associated legal costs last year.
Wow.
That's crazy. Now, if you
Seems like a
had
lot.
somebody, that's a lot.
Seems like a lot.
Can you imagine the bill if somebody mistranslated a tumor for a cyst because they used Google Translate?
Yeah,
And can
or
you
more. I'm
imagine
thinking more like in the kind of really acute, highly stressful
that?
maternity setting, right? If it, you know, in the
Right.
in a, in a, you know, on a ward, and there's you know, because it's very stressful when that's happening, and someone's trying to use a phone to do Google Translate, and like it just gets mistranslated, and someone says, "Oh no, it could just be awful."
Exactly. And so AI in my mind should trust, you know, should support clinical judgment, not override it. So what we want to do is we want to provide clinicians with an informed choice. If they've got a suite of solutions, they can go to the basic AI and go, okay, well, let's have some initial triage and conversation. How are you feeling today? You know, do you want a cup of tea? Do you want, you know, when do you want to see the patient? Have you got an appointment? Fabulous. But actually, if we're starting to step up and going something like Martha's rule.
What's Martha's rule?
So Martha's rule is a new piece of legislation where a clinician, when they're doing obs, must ask the patient how they were feeling compared to how they were feeling the previous time or the day before they were asked that same question due to a death where that question was asked. And the patient said that they were fine, but actually they weren't fine compared to the last time they were asked that question. And as a result, they died. And so now there is a requirement to with Martha's rule, where wherever there is a for children, it's every time obs are taken. For adults, it's once a day. You have to ask them, how are you feeling compared to when we last, you know, when we last asked you. That's quite specific. Now, you can't be assured that Google Translate is going to do that. You need to be assured that that is done every time in those 167 languages. So it's fine doing it in French, German, and Spanish, but actually, like you said, in your Igbo, your Twi, your Oromo, maybe not so. And as an interpreting and language provider, we need to offer that equity of access and that assurance that that quality is sustained across every language that we provide.
And do
And
you, sorry, go on, go on.
yeah, and so the ability to move between kind of the basic solutions, which is AI, to telephone, to video, to face-to-face, gives that clinician that informed choice to go, right, I now need to switch to that, or I need to now use this person, or you know, if it's getting particularly complex or in mental health, actually they need to be here in person to support that patient effectively.
And have you had like much pushback about this sort of conceptually? Not necessarily the deployment of it, but like the idea that this is a good idea in general. Just
I think
curious.
that, yeah, I think kind of for us, AI is kind of moved from experimentation,
Oh,
if you like.
I meant in general. I meant like conceptually, just the idea of providing all these languages, however.
Yeah, I mean, generally a clinician understands because they've had a lived experience of a challenge that they may have had with the patient. Yeah. Sometimes you have issues with people not understanding why and how and the impact. And yeah. that's not anybody's fault, but it's they've never had, you know, they've been English speaking, they speak one language, they've never really seen the impact of that language barrier. Mm-hmm. And there is that assumption that I'll give you a classic example. I think one that really frustrates me or a regular issue is when somebody is deaf.
Okay.
You know, clinicians assume that they must be able to read and write as well. So we'll just write it down. We don't need to provide a British Sign Language interpreter. We'll just write it down and that'll be fine. Actually, that's not the case, right? Some deaf patients cannot read and write, and therefore they need an interpreter to be able to effectively communicate.
Right.
If you imagine that you've got a language barrier and overlay that with a sensory impairment as well, that can be quite daunting in you know, critical situations where you may be in labor or you're about to go through a really serious procedure or receive bad news.
Yeah.
There's a duty of care.
Yeah, I think that's it, right? So there is a duty of care to ensure that the patient understands what's going on, right? Basically. Is that true? Absolutely. That must be true.
Absolutely.
Okay, fine. Which then basically means that if you are a society with that welcomes, as we do, all of these different cultures, then it's an obligation on the healthcare service to be able to effectively communicate what's going on.
Exactly that. And, you know, you see it in private healthcare as well through patient concierge services where, you know, if there is a patient who is being treated privately, there is the ability to have interpreting and translation support to make sure that they receive that the best level of care throughout their treatment.
Yeah, I can see on the private side of things this being really obvious to do.
Yeah.
Like, why wouldn't you? I think, yeah, makes sense. So what are, because it can't have all been plain sailing, so what have been some of the biggest challenges that you've had to kind of overcome?
I think one of the biggest challenges is training and understanding. You know, a lot of these clinicians have 1,000 systems, 1,000 different places to report to and things to do when it comes to treating a patient. This is almost an oversight, you know, and when they are faced with a patient with a language barrier, it's very easy to use friends or family or the children or, you know, try and make do and use broken English. But that can lead to more problems further down the line for lots and lots of different reasons. And that cultural awareness piece is so, so important. Mm. We don't always appreciate the impact of making just decisions like that. When we don't, because not everybody knows about different cultures and the impact of certain actions. So a big piece for us has been around training. How can we ensure that every time you see a patient, you know how to treat them, you know what to do, and making sure that there's a very clear process to make sure that clinicians know what they do. And that a lot of that heavy lifting now is done with interoperability systems. So how do we, you know, making sure that the interpreter is booked well before the clinician even knows that they need an interpreter, making sure that that's integrated with EPR systems and,
So can they book it through the EPR, the electronic health record?
That's now great. With our systems, absolutely. You essentially, we integrate with EPR systems such that when an appointment is booked, the interpreter is booked. So there is no need to think about, hang on, what does that patient need? Because it's already arranged. And taking away some of that second guessing and that kind of panic at the front line is kind of where our technologies now are evolving to. It's how do we kind of anticipate that need and then kind of embed it throughout the patient journey?
Okay.
So even something like PopDoc, you know, how do we make sure that it's equitable and make sure that it's considered for every patient that may want to use it.
So we've had a number of conversations around translations and things like that. So that stuff, I completely agree with you that you know, it's absolutely necessary to make sure if you take a view that health equity and equality of access is will result in better patient outcomes, then you have to be able to provide things in languages that are going to help people get better outcomes, basically. So yeah, completely agree.
And it's demonstrated time and again with multiple different reports, you know, and investigations and inquiries. Like I said, the Darzi report, the Ockenden report, when we're looking at, there was an interpreting translation review done and a framework released that kind of identified the importance of communication, effective communication support, and a cultural awareness to affect patient outcomes.
Yeah, I think it's going to become more and more of an issue. And I just hope it doesn't get lumped in to the immigration debate, because I think it's very different questions. But I feel like, unfortunately, there's a risk that it could.
Absolutely. But it's, I think that there were, there's, to your point, I think that it may get lumped into that. But actually, the NHS trust that we work with, a lot of those clinicians, a lot of the people who are on the front line, they get it. Because they're seeing the impact. So, you know,
the here's and whys and where's of wherever someone came from is irrelevant at the point of care, basically. Absolutely. Because that person will either have a positive outcome or a negative outcome, and we should be, the whole point of the healthcare system is to optimize for better outcomes.
It underpins the ethos of the NHS. Underpins the purpose of it, which is to help every person accessing, every patient to receive the best possible level of care.
Yeah, I completely agree. We are going to go for our final commercial break, and then we will be right back with the final part of today's show with Kavita Palmer from Word360 on our Digital Health Rewired special. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the last part of today's show with my guest today, Kavita Palmer, who is the CEO and founder of Word360. So compared to being an optometrist, I'll ask it a different way. What was it that motivated you to leave, you know, safe, good, positive career to go off and be entrepreneurial in a variety of different ways?
I think, so it kind of leads back to why I became an optometrist in the first place, Steve. I actually wanted to be an architect.
Okay.
as you do.
Yeah.
And, I was doing my A-levels and I was thinking of a career in architecture, and I went to a careers convention and I was speaking to an architect there, and it was going back a few years, it's 94, and I was speaking to an architect, and he's like, oh no, you don't want to be an architect. God, there's no money in that. Don't do it. Do something else.
Okay.
So that's kind of how I fell into optometry, because one of my friends was doing optometry and I had no clue what it was.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, well, actually, you know, you can work in a practice or you can work for yourself. And, you know, it's good money. I was like, okay,
like, what's the difference between optometry and being an optician?
So optician is kind of the general name, but an optometrist is the person who actually tests your eyes, who actually has that clinical insight.
Okay.
Whereas an optician, you could have a dispensing optician, you can just kind of dispense you the glasses.
Right. But
you've got an ophthalmic optician who will actually test your eyes and do all the clinical stuff at the back.
Okay. And is it the same type of, you have to go to medical school and do all of this stuff, or do you go to optometry school?
You go to optometry school, so you your 3 years, yeah, and then you have to do what's called a professional qualifying. So you have to go out into practice and then you sit your professional qualifying exams.
Okay.
Optometrist.
Okay. And so how does that end up with you deciding to go off and be a serial entrepreneur?
Well, you can tell that obviously I was not going to follow the conventional route. And my father was very disappointed when I thought, I can't just do the same thing over and over for the rest of my life. And it was really the fact that I kind of always used to think of solving problems. I think you'll know, Steve, you know, when you've got the bug and you think that you can do it better, or you think that there's a problem you can solve, I've always been spurred on to kind of try that. And so after 11 years of kind of doing optometry, I just felt like I could do something else and help people doing something differently, which is when I set up my first company, which was Adapt2Wear.
Which was the clothing company for elderly people.
Correct. Yes.
So what are some of the things that have been the hardest things about running businesses that you didn't think would be hard?
How long have we got? I've already got like 14 minutes to this. I think when you run your own business, you are the jack of all trades. You're doing everything. You're running around and you're kind of doing everything. And it's failing fast, learning quickly, and trying to let go of things. For me personally, everyone has their own different challenges. But for me, it was kind of you had to have your finance hat on and your HR hat on. And it's, knowing a little bit about everything to move the business forward. So for me, that was one of the biggest challenges. And trusting your gut, I think that's the one thing that I've become a master of that I wasn't when I first did. That self-doubt and that is something that I hear time and again when I speak to friends and peers is, feeling like you can't do it and kind of getting over yourself.
Yeah, or like, even if I don't think I can, what's the worst that's going to happen?
Exactly. And that pivotal point, I mean, I remember when I first developed WordSki, I had no tech background. I didn't know how to build tech. Mm. I don't know about yourself, when you're building tech, I didn't know what to do. So all I knew was that particular technology could be a solution for the problem that I had.
Yeah.
However, it was a massive learning curve to know how to build technology. I remember, in the Midlands at the time, there really wasn't a tech industry. There wasn't really abundance of Node.js developers and people who, CTOs and, all the suite of kind of technical expertise that you have now. So I ended up taking a really big gamble and going into Europe and going, right, I can't afford it back in the UK. I'm going to try and nearshore and get it cheap. And the guys are sitting around the table going, right, we've got you. Because I was sitting there going, right, can I have a green button here? Can I have a table here? Yeah. Nothing about UX or the back end or the tech stack, none of that stuff. It was, can I make it look pretty here? And they saw me coming a mile off. So kind of learning that, failing, developing a product that wasn't really fit for purpose, but was amazing because it solved a problem. And then really quickly having to go, oh my God, it doesn't work. As well as, I can't scale this. How do I build my tech team?
Right.
For me, that was probably one of the biggest learning curves and one of the scariest things that I've had to do.
Yeah, I think lots of people listening, I can certainly relate to large parts of that. I think I think the scale, I think what you said there is really insightful, which is the ability to sort of push past that voice inside you that says you can't do it or it might not work and just kind of go for it. There are so many people, I think, that listen to that voice of self-doubt, and the chances are it will fail, right? I mean, just statistics. I mean, it's like you might, like, as in if you just purely looked at the stats, right?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it, you're not going to learn things and you're not going to be a better version of yourself by going through that process. And what if it works? Like, most people worry about what if it doesn't work, but what if it works? What if it actually comes off?
Right. You fail 100% of the things you don't try, right?
100%. I completely agree with that. And, sorry, go on.
Yeah, no, absolutely agree. I mean, if I look at Adapt2Wear, when I set that up, I was too early into the market. I was doing silver technology and fabrics. I was doing magnetic shirts and things, open back clothing. It was a phenomenal product. Right now you can go, oh my God, I can use that everywhere. You can start seeing some of that popping into your high streets now. But back then, we were too early in the market. It wasn't a product, but it didn't mean it failed. It meant that it just wasn't the right time. But that could have either stifled my need to kind of go on and try again something different.
I do as well. This is one of the things that, I have to constantly work on myself, which is viewing this sort of success or failure like it's binary. It isn't. It's first of all, it's really based on your own subjectivity, right? That's the first thing. There is no like external arbiter, you know, there's no one like judging everyone. So, I mean, some people think that there is, but in this instance, you know, like what I mean is there isn't sort of like some referee somewhere that's determining who's successful and who's failed. It's really just from your own brain. And then secondly, like making it binary is dumb. It's really dumb because it isn't binary. It's this kind of weird spectrum of, you know, the multiverse of potential outcomes. And, it, you know, even if it doesn't, you could argue it's never failed. You know what I mean? Like, because you always learn something. So,
It's like learning to walk. How many of us can walk? You know, it's something that, you know, when you don't have your own inhibitions, you just keep trying. You look at babies, they fall how many times before they get up and go, right, I got it.
What kind of advice would you give to anyone looking or trying to scale within the NHS? Which is, and it's not a loaded question, it's a genuine question. I have my own thoughts on this, but what are your kind of learnings having done it?
I think that it's a very difficult beast. And perseverance is key. I think that, you know, if you look at it now, it's so much easier to do work in the NHS than it's ever been. There are very, very clear pathways. I mean, I'm on the board for Health Innovation West Midlands. Mm. And, you know, for us trying to get some of these small SMEs, these startups to kind of work with the NHS, those pathways didn't exist. Now, there's so much help out there to help. And the NHS is keen. It's eager to learn. It wants new products. It wants solutions to problems. And so my advice would be seek out those conduits. So there is like, you know, like I said, health innovation networks are phenomenal to helping you and giving you advice on how you can access the NHS, how you can work with the NHS. And not to be disheartened if it doesn't go right straight away, and not to take it personally. It goes back to your point, which is keep on trying. If it doesn't work in one trust, try another one, because each one is different.
So my background, so it's interesting you mentioned the Health Innovation Networks. I love them. We love them. So at PogTalk, they've been amazing for us. So one of the things, they come in for a lot of stick, though. We're a broad church on this show, so some people might know what the Health Innovation Network is. It's basically this kind of NHS organizations on a local level that are designed to be a translational layer between the NHS system and innovative technology companies that want to work with the NHS. So sort of like signposting all the way up to sort of partnering, basically to try and make it easier to cross that bridge from an incredibly stressed, resource constrained, clinically driven system with sort of a really, really diverse technology marketplace, and be that kind of layer in the middle. So they come in for a lot of stick, and I think they come in for a lot of stick really unfairly, mostly from clinical founders who don't have a sales background and aren't really interested in building a proper sales functionality themselves. This is my take anyway, a proper B2B functioning sales skill set in their business. And they basically want to be able to go to somebody and have that somebody give them partnerships, basically. And I think that's how people sort of misuse the Health Innovation Network. And they think, well, I'm my thing's really innovative. I'm an expert clinician. And I went and spoke to the Health Innovation Network and they didn't give me any business.
Yeah.
Well, that's not really the aim point. Of it.
Yes, but I think that leads to your point, which is, you know, there is that disconnect between a commercial NAS and commercialization. So, you know, it's clinical NAS and commercialization. To be successful, you need to have both. And it's making sure that if you do have a product or have a service, seeking out whether, you know, not getting stuck on that product, you have to be realistic about whether it's actually, whether you've done your market research, whether you've done your, you know, analysis on whether there are routes to market and whether there's appetite for that product.
I sort of talk at various things and, you know, mentor various startups and things like that, and I love it when people say, I tried to speak to the Health Innovation Network but they weren't really interested, and I'm like, well, did you look at their website? Because they're on their website, they tell you what they're interested in. Like, they pretty much, their whole job is to basically tell you what they're interested in. So It's kind of out there. Look, anyway, we're into the last 2 minutes of the show, and we've covered a little bit of this already. But what is the one motto that you return to, your kind of self-talk that you rely on when things are tough that you want to pass on to the world? I ask every guest this, by the way, at the end of the show.
I think it's a self-belief where I always say to myself, no one can tell you can't do something. And for me, I always talk to myself in that positive tone to go, don't tell me you can't do it.
Right. Makes sense.
Plain and
Perfect.
simple.
Don't tell me you can't do it. On that note, Kavita, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you to Digital Health Rewired, who we are partnered with. Again, check out the socials. You can get a 10% discount if you book with the code RW26HTH. Go to the event, it's fantastic. And we will be back. Actually, we're in a couple of weeks, we're going to be broadcasting live from the event, but we will be back again next week with another show. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening.